is using the rules of Congress to make their point one final time before this impeachment vote.
We have the latest for you in the process aimed at impeaching the U.S. president. This is Friday, December 13th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, mass rallies in India following the enactment of a controversial immigration measure. North Korea says the United States had nothing to offer for possible renewed talks aimed at getting Pyongyang to give up its nuclear and missile program. And late word has it that New Zealand officials have sent crews to a volcano and recovered bodies. The Democratic-controlled U.S. House Judiciary Committee continued Thursday to debate articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump, but expects to rebuff Republican attempts to weaken the allegations and then send them to the full House of Representatives for a vote next week. The panel began its debate late Wednesday and continued Thursday with Democratic lawmakers laying out the case that Trump abused his presidential power by pushing Ukraine to investigate one of his chief 2020 Democratic election rivals, former Vice President Joe Biden, and then obstructed Congress by refusing to cooperate with congressional investigators. Meanwhile, Republicans on the committee have argued the Democrats have not made their case and are rushing to judgment. Once the committee does approve the articles, the full House is expected to vote on them. If, as expected, the House approves the articles, the matter would then go over for trial to the Republican majority Senate, which Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Wednesday would happen next month. A conviction in the Senate would lead to Trump's removal from office, but that is highly unlikely because at least 20 Republicans would have to side with Democrats to achieve the required threshold of 67 of the chamber's 100 members. Joining us from Capitol Hill is Catherine Gibson, VOA's congressional correspondent. Where do we stand now, Catherine, and what happens next?
Well, right now we are immersed in the debate over articles of impeachment. This is the last step that lawmakers have to take, preparing the legislation to get to a full House floor vote, which will likely happen early next week.
So why is this taking so long? I mean, it's being televised here all through the United States, various parts of the world. And every time you look up at the television set and look at the screen or look online or anything, they're just arguing and arguing and arguing. Is this the way it's supposed to be? Is this just the way it is from now on?
I think it's just the way it is from now on because of how contentious this impeachment debate has become up here on Capitol Hill, and because this is a stage in the process that's very procedural, where there are a lot of kind of inside rules that Republicans can use to slow down the process and to have an opportunity to make their points about President Trump and what they believe is his innocence in all of this and the basic unfairness of why he shouldn't be impeached. So they're really using the rules of Congress to make their points one final time before this impeachment vote.
The Democrats on the committee, the Judicial Committee, and as well as those who are on the Intelligence Committee, are saying that the Republicans have not brought up any facts. They have just brought up a diversion as far as these charges might be concerned.
That's right. We really have seen kind of a repeat of the arguments that we've been hearing over the past few weeks up here on Capitol Hill, which is the process argument from House Republicans. The system, the way that House Democrats have set up the process, is fundamentally unfair to the president, that they have not had an opportunity for a so-called minority day, which would basically be an opportunity for them to call in their own witnesses to make their own arguments for the innocence of President Donald Trump and to say that he doesn't deserve to be impeached. Now, House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler has said that that is not something that's appropriate to happen at this point in the process, that they need to mark up the articles of impeachment and then something like that could happen. Of course, we do know that with the plans moving forward for the impeachment vote next week, that's highly unlikely. Democrats, of course, also say that the president was given the opportunity to send his own counsel to all of these different intelligence and judiciary committee hearings, and he declined that opportunity.
Overall, how has President Trump reacted to what's going on?
He has tweeted numerous times today, one of the heaviest tweet days of his presidency so far by most accounts. He has said that it's a witch hunt. He has said that it's a fundamentally unfair process, the argument that's been taken up by House Republicans and echoed up here on Capitol Hill. He's also called it impeachment light, which is a very interesting phrase that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked to address this morning in her weekly press conference. She really pushed back against that idea of the president and said, you have an article of impeachment that's alleging he abused the power of his office, as well as obstructed Congress's ability to investigate his misuse of power. Those are two pretty strong articles of impeachment, the speaker argued, and she said she was very happy with them and felt good about them and felt the American public was behind her on it.
I think you're probably expecting another all-nighter, is that right?
I think that is very, very possible.
That's Catherine Gibson, the VOA congressional correspondent, joining us from Capitol Hill. And we invite you to read more in our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. The United States Thursday urged China not to interfere in elections next month in Taiwan, where President Tsai Ing-wen, a critic of Beijing, is seeking a new term. Animal rights activists have slammed Donald Trump Jr. after it emerged that he killed an endangered sheep in Mongolia and was retroactively issued a hunting permit by the country's authorities, raising questions about whether he received special treatment. Protesters in Hong Kong have written hundreds of Christmas cards for people jailed in the city's pro-democracy movement, promising they will not be forgotten as they face spending the festive season behind bars. And South Korean health authorities have found vitamin E acetate, which may be linked to lung illness, in some liquid e-cigarettes. India has sent thousands of troops into the northeastern state of Assam Thursday to quell violent protests triggered by a new law that would make it easier for non-Muslims from some neighboring countries to gain citizenship. Michael Kugelman of the Wilson Center here in Washington joins us. What's going on here, Michael?
Well, there's a lot to unpack. There's nothing simple about this. What we're looking at is a new citizenship bill that was recently passed by both chambers of the Indian legislature that would enable migrants from several neighboring countries of India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, to get citizenship in India, but only if they are non-Muslim migrants. So in other words, if you're a persecuted Hindu in Pakistan, you'll be welcomed with open arms in India and in a position to apply for citizenship. But if we're talking about Muslim migrants from any of those countries, then this will not apply. So clearly the controversy lies in the fact that it appears that India has passed an overtly discriminatory new citizenship law by essentially making decisions on citizenship based on the idea of religion. And, given where this government in India has been going over the last 2 years, I don't think we should be surprised. This isn't a government led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi that is a conservative nationalist government that subscribes very aggressively to the idea of Hindu nationalism, which essentially means there's a need to emphasize efforts to elevate and enhance the status of the Hindu majority in India, both in state and society. And that entails, unfortunately, relegating Indian Muslims or other Muslims that happen to be in India to the margins, to the periphery. And so, I think what we're seeing here is another example. It's not the first one, but another example in this Modi government of efforts to pursue this Hindu nationalist strategy in a more aggressive fashion than we have seen in the past. And, what's significant here is India is a Hindu majority state, but you're looking at a country with about 200 million Muslims and a country of more than 1 billion people. And India has always prided itself on its secular pluralistic traditions upheld in the Constitution. And so this new citizenship bill appears to go against those longstanding principles.
Well, he appears to have quite a bit of support, does the Prime Minister, Mr. Modi. However, most of these demonstrations, I hear, are being held and staged by people who don't want other people coming into the country. Is that correct?
Well, you're right. It's true. I mean, one may think that these would be Muslims that are out there in the streets protesting because they're afraid that, you know, their ability to keep living in India may be jeopardized. But it's true that you've had a number of protesters, particularly in Assam, in the state of Assam, who are not Muslims. They are represent other religions. And what they worry about is that this new bill could actually encourage immigration in general of other non-Muslim refugees from these other countries, meaning that these are, interestingly enough, conservative, I would describe them as politically conservative citizens of India who are opposed to the idea of immigration, and they feel that the citizenship bill may prevent, it may discourage Muslim migrants from coming in, but it may encourage Hindus from Pakistan or from Afghanistan or from Bangladesh or Zoroastrians or whatever the case may be. So there's a lot going on here, and I think it indicates to me that this citizenship bill, so long as the Supreme Court does not strike it down, and I imagine that there will be a challenge that goes to the Supreme Court, if this new bill becomes the law of the land, I think it's going to pose a lot of challenges for the Indian government.
Michael Kugelman, South Asia expert at the Wilson Center here in Washington. Thanks as always, Michael.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Happening now in Asia, the Afghan Taliban says it wrapped up nearly a week of peace negotiations Thursday with the United States and Qatar in a good and positive atmosphere, but the insurgent group did not report any breakthrough. Both sides have agreed to resume the talks after a few days. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us on VOA Asia. North Korea said Thursday that the United States had nothing to offer for possible renewed talks aimed at getting Pyongyang to give up its nuclear and missile programs. That after Washington said it was ready to take concrete steps towards securing a deal. It criticized the United States for convening a UN Security Council meeting Wednesday, calling it a foolish thing which would help Pyongyang make a clear decision on which path it would take. The 15-member Security Council met as concerns grow internationally that North Korea could resume nuclear or long-range missile testing suspended since 2017 because denuclearization talks between Pyongyang and Washington have stalled. My VOA colleague Steve Miller spoke with Harry Kasianis, Korea Studies Director at the Center for the National Interest, about the story.
You know, I think comments like that, at least for now, I'm going to attribute to domestic politics in North Korea. I think it's very clear that Kim Jong-un, probably wounded a little bit from what happened in Hanoi and not getting a deal after traveling thousands of miles by train, and essentially foreshadowing in North Korean media, we forget that it looked like he thought he was going to come away with a deal, still has to feel and show that he is going to be tough towards the United States. The question now is, what will Kim do for his supposed Christmas gift to Donald Trump? He's declared this year-end deadline. Everybody wants to know what he's going to do. There's only two paths. One, he tests an ICBM or nuclear weapon, sparks a crisis. Or two, if he does something below that threshold, I think his restraint would be rewarded. When Donald Trump comes out of impeachment, I think he's going to be looking for a big foreign policy win. That win could be North Korea, but I think it's up to Kim at this point.
Do you really think that anything less than a nuclear test or an ICBM launch would be rewarded? Because he hasn't been rewarded for the short-range tests in the past. I mean, the United States says that doesn't violate the agreement that they have, but it hasn't moved the needle toward negotiations, even with Special Representative Steve Biegun slated to be in Seoul next week.
I think the timing here is the key, I think, more than anything else. I think we have just a very unique set of circumstances that haven't happened prior. I think Kim, in a way, has sort of boxed himself in by this year-end deadline. He knows he has to do something. At the same time, U.S. domestic politics is actually quite interesting these days with impeachment and a potential very quick Senate trial. So if everything to work out perfectly, if Kim was to do something below that ICBM or nuclear threshold, maybe a satellite launch, maybe a intermediate range ballistic missile test, there's lots of ways that you could sort of thread that needle. And if Donald Trump chooses not to respond, not going crazy on Twitter or something like that, I think after he gets through impeachment, Trump is going to need some sort of foreign policy win. Because let's face it, a lot of his other foreign policy gambits, whether it's Syria, Iran, they have not been transformative. So I think for him, I think North Korea is the obvious choice. And I think that, I think everybody knows what the contours of that deal look like. It's something very similar to Hanoi. The closure of Yongbyon, the full nuclear facility for some sort of temporary or you know, snapback provisions in terms of sanctions relief. I think that's the deal that could be done. I think that's the deal that builds trust. I know a lot of people won't like that deal because it doesn't go to full towards denuclearization right off the bat. But if we're looking to achieve something that can change the status quo between Pyongyang and Washington, that's the deal. But a lot of things have to happen for that to fall through and make it happen. So we'll have to see.
Harry Kazianis is the Director of Korean Studies over at the Center for the National Interest. Thank you very much for your insight today.
Always a pleasure.
Coming your way, Aung San Suu Kyi has seemingly lost many of her international supporters. That's coming up. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Bloomberg News, is reporting that President Trump has signed off on a so-called Phase 1 trade deal with China, averting the December 15th introduction of a new wave of U.S. tariffs on about $160 billion of consumer goods from the Asian nation. That, according, says Bloomberg, to people familiar with the matter. This is VOA Asia. As Myanmar State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi addressed the International Court of Justice in The Hague this week, many former supporters looked on with dismay as the Nobel Peace Laureate denied accusations that Myanmar's military conducted atrocities against the Rohingya Muslim population. Prosecution lawyers say their actions do amount to genocide, and many of her critics say she bears some responsibility for the continued persecution of the Muslim minority, three-quarters of a million of whom have fled the country. Henry Ridgewell has more.
Earlier this month, in Myanmar's western town of Pathein, dozens of Rohingya Muslims were crammed into overcrowded cells. They were jailed on charges of traveling illegally in the country. Human rights groups say it's evidence the Rohingya are still suffering gross abuses.
Rohingya are not granted freedom of movement. We've documented recently forced labor of Rohingya and restrictions on the right to nationality. And we believe that the International Court of Justice should urgently put in place provisional measures in order to end the persecution and ongoing violence against the Rohingya in Rakhine State.
Myanmar's state councillor Aung San Suu Kyi this week defended the country's military against accusations that it waged genocide against the Rohingya. She says their actions were a legitimate response to terrorism.
Myanmar requests the court to remove the case from its list. Steps that generate suspicion, sow doubts, or create resentment between communities who have just begun to build a fragile foundation of trust could undermine reconciliation.
Her appearance and words at The Hague have dismayed many in the West.
The fact that she whitewashed and her team whitewashed the genocide that took place, or did not mention the fact that there was any mass rape, any sexual and gender-based violence that took place, it was quite disturbing.
Aung San Suu Kyi was once seen as a global beacon for human rights, standing up against a military regime that kept her prisoner for most of two decades until 2010. A Nobel Peace Prize winner in 1991, she became leader of Myanmar's civilian government in 2016. Former supporters have become vocal critics, accusing her of failing to stop the atrocities against the Rohingya.
She was one person who could have brought people together. She had admiration across religions, across ethnic groups in the country. And she's chosen, instead of doing that, to do the opposite. It turns out that she also has these Buddhist nationalist feelings. that she shares the prejudice against the Rohingya, and she is pursuing policies discriminating against them.
Aung San Suu Kyi retains millions of mainly Buddhist supporters in Myanmar. They insist she is doing her best to govern a multi-ethnic country where the military still holds the reins of power. But Myanmar's minorities feel betrayed.
Other ethnic people are looking at her at this court, defending the military, a military that's committed the same sort of crimes against them for years, and thinking, how can we ever trust this person? How can we trust this woman now?
Will you ever say sorry, Minister?
That's a sentiment shared by many across the globe, who say Aung San Suu Kyi's fall from grace could hardly be more disheartening. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This news break from VOA Asia. China's aviation regulator said Thursday it expected a decline in airline capacity and bookings to the United States and Australia over the Lunar New Year period for the first time in 4 years due to a shift in tourist destinations. They say most people now be going to Japan, Thailand, and South Korea. You're listening to VOA Asia. New Zealand officials sent crews to White Island to recover the bodies of 8 people killed in Monday's volcanic eruption. Authorities had been holding off on sending search crews to retrieve the bodies because of the volcano's continued instability. Seismologists with New Zealand's GeoNet Seismic Monitoring Agency said Wednesday there remains a 40 to 60% chance of another major eruption. Poisonous gas continues to vent out of the volcano's crater, and the island is covered in acidic ash. Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks has more.
Some 20 square feet of skin was sent to New Zealand from Australia on Wednesday. It's among donations to save victims severely burned by a volcanic eruption this week. However, it's only a fraction of what New Zealand's ordered, nearly 1,300 square feet of skin. In the wake of Monday's deadly event, surgeons have been working around the clock to treat survivors at hospitals around the country. The head of one Australian tissue bank explained why the skin is so critical.
So skin is used in life-saving surgery. So skin is predominantly used in patients who have the most life-threatening burns. Usually if they have more than 50% burn over their body, there isn't enough of their own skin to transplant onto the bone burn wounds. So in that case, there is no alternative.
The death toll has been rising through the week, and more than 20 people are in intensive care. Another 8 are presumed dead on the island. The amount of skin needed to save victims equates to about 60 donors. However, the New Zealand Herald reports that only 5 to 10 people donate skin each year in the country. Jorge Villapalos, a lead surgeon for plastics and grafting in London, says when the donations do arrive, surgeons will be tested to the limits of their expertise.
What we need to analyze here is that these are exceptional circumstances by all stretch of the imagination. And to illustrate this, I would say that our colleagues in New Zealand have had maybe the work of a whole year thrown at them in a single day.
On Thursday, Maori prayers were offered for victims of the tragedy. Authorities confirmed that they plan to recover victims' bodies from White Island Friday morning. Previous efforts have been deemed unsafe, as experts say there's a 50 to 60% chance of another eruption.
This is Science in a Minute.
As NASA continues to work toward its goal of returning people to the moon by 2024, the space agency is also looking further into the future with its plans of someday landing humans on Mars. A number of challenges must first be met before people can travel to and actually function on the red planet. Among them is picking the right landing spot. A major consideration in picking a location is that it should offer a ready supply of natural resources, such as water, that would be used for not only human consumption, but also for the generation of energy. A new study from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory could help in this selection process by providing a map of where water ice, located in as little as 2.5 centimeters below the surface, can be found. Data from NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Odyssey Orbiter was used to create the Mars Water Map. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for that. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Have a great weekend.